Shall we all rise for the reading of God's word? Today's message is from Jeremiah chapter 51, verses 41 through 44. How Shishak has been captured, and the praise of the whole earth been seized. How Babylon has become an object of horror among the nations. The sea has come up over Babylon. She has been engulfed with its tumultuous waves. Her cities have become an object of horror, a parched land and a desert, a land in which no man lives and through which no son of man passes. I will punish Bel in Babylon, and I will make what he has swallowed come out of his mouth, and the nations will no longer stream to him. Even the wall of Babylon has fallen down. Thank you. Please be seated.
Well, we go through this chapter, and obviously we're talking about a destroyer. The sense is that we don't need any destroyers around here, and God says we need destroyers. I've created them for a purpose. In fact, this is an interesting verse you might want to put off the side. I think we've repeated it before, but in Proverbs 16:4 it reads this way. The Lord has made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of evil. Everything has its purpose. And in this particular passage, it's clear that God is stirring up the spirit of the destroyer, and the destroyer is coming in for one purpose, and that is to destroy. Isaiah chapter 33 makes mention of this again, and really conveys that God has a use for it, then will ultimately destroy the destroyer. So as we come to this passage, and as we have been going through the chapter, what we have seen are the different reasons for the destroyer to exist. And if you were to ever ask, you know, how can I know what is real? How can I know what is lasting? God would say, well, just send in the destroyer. Because once the destroyer comes in, whatever is left standing is real. It's forever. But whatever has gone is fake. So the fact that God uses the destroyer really to, as we look at the very beginning of the chapter, to blow away what is worthless and what is false and what is fake and what is phony and what is not true is God doing us a favor, because otherwise we would have embraced those things and held on to those things. The fact that difficulties come in our lives and problems come in our life and the reality of promises that are easily broken are revealed through the time of destruction is God's graciousness to us, because he is letting us know, you don't want to trust in this. You don't want to hold on to this. You don't want to embrace this, because when the final day comes, you won't be standing. One of the verses in Matthew is Jesus says, you know, the wise man builds his house upon the rock. You don't want to build your house upon the sand, because you know, the waters and the waves and that's the destroyer. Comes in and takes everything away. So it's a very interesting concept, but God is really revealing not only what is true and what is worthless, but he's revealing what is weak and what is wicked, what is the genuine person that is a believer. I mean, there are people who want to do wrong, but there are people who want to do right but still do wrong. And God makes a distinction, and God is the one that's going to save the one that longs to do right. I mean, he is on their side. But the bottom line is that it's God who is doing the saving, and he sees the difference. He makes the distinctions. And I think one thing that has also been clear is that God literally exposes the vulnerability of sin. We perceive and sin boast of great things. I mean, you know, sin says that it's always going to be there, that it's going to be able to do the things to make you happy and that you're going to have a fulfilled life. But the fact of the matter is once the evidence of it begins to be revealed, you go, okay, that was really deceptive. It was really worthless. It was really unreliable. It's very disappointing. And God goes, yeah, that's why I sent him the destroyer, to help you see that. Because otherwise, once again, we would have put our trust in those things. And they actually cause a tremendous amount of hurt and tremendous amount of pain because of their disappointment. To go a little bit further within the passage, clearly God reveals his sovereignty and his power. And when the destroyer comes and begins to destroy all those things that really declare themselves as God, you begin to realize, okay, maybe they're not God after all. And of course, obviously, that is one of the great purposes of what God is doing. To destroy the destructive ones is clearly the job that God is given into the hands of the destroyers. The best way for me to put this is destruction has to come to those that are destroying lives. Who do you want to do the job? Oh, I'll do it. No, you don't want that job. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful thing that God has taken us out of the realm of being a destroyer. And he says, I've got my own group of people that handle that stuff. They'll take care of it for you. You don't have to do it. And, you know, it continues to bring us back to Romans chapter 12, where he says, you know, I only have you for one purpose, and that is to do good. And for the rest of your life, you get to do that. But I've got these guys to handle the bad. A lot of interesting passages in dealing with this, but let me just share a couple with you. In 1 Chronicles chapter 21, there's an interesting scene in which David begins to number his troops. And of course, it begins to be revealed as a heinous, terrible crime before God. Of course, many of us go, what's the big deal? But anyway, so what has to happen is what? Well, what has to happen is a punishment that comes. If you look within the text, of course, if you look in Kings, it's actually recorded in the book of Kings, but if you look in Chronicles, it's recorded this way, and Satan stood up. That's an interesting phrase, which means that Satan volunteered for the job. Now, the point is that David did something terrible. What was it he did so terrible? Okay, here's what he did. He began to put his trust in his power. Now you go, well, that's not so terrible. Well, wait a minute. If, in fact, he's the king of Israel, and he's setting the standards for this nation that is actually declared to be a nation that will exist forever, if, in fact, he's the king of this, then he's putting his trust in something that is going to disappoint. More specifically, he's putting his trust not only in himself, but in his warriors. I've got news for you. Israel never has been strong enough to defeat the world and to defeat evil. So you put your trust in your ability and you say, okay, God, I think I got this from here. What are you setting your nation up for? For failure. They have to put their trust in God. And they have to see. So what is God going to do? Well, God's going to show them just how helpless they are. What does he do? He releases a destroyer. Okay, go ahead. Fight them. Who will volunteer? Satan goes, I will. I'll volunteer. He goes, okay, go. So the destroyer goes in and David goes, whoa, I don't think I can handle this. And God says, I know, that's what I've been telling you. See? But the destroyer is necessary to reveal the lie of what David was thinking and the trust that he was putting in. So 1 Chronicles 21:1, Satan stood up and would be the one who would destroy. Well, I mean, who's the best one to destroy pride? The prideful one, right? So he does a great job. Another good example, and I'll have you turn to it, is found in 1 Kings. 1 Kings, and if you look with me in chapter 22, we have an example of Ahab. Interesting story. Certainly a lot of details we could go into in this particular chapter, but suffice it to say, Ahab's a really bad king, a wicked king. He wants to put his trust in his gods. Of course, his wife, Jezebel, you know, loves all the false prophets and has been courting them. If you look within the passage in 1 Kings chapter 22, they're about ready to go to war. And, of course, Ahab's thinking, all I need to hear is good news, guys. So he surrounds himself with prophets, false prophets, but he surrounds himself with prophets that will tell him what he wants to hear. You're going off to war. What do you want to hear? You're going to win. So Here we go in chapter 22, verse 5. Moreover, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, who is his son-in-law, please first inquire of the word of the Lord. And the king of Israel gathered a prophet to gather together about 400. I mean, if you have a lot of prophets and they all agree, then obviously it's true, right? They gathered about 400 men, and they said to them, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we refrain? And they said, go. The Lord is with you. You're going to win. No problem. Jehoshaphat says, okay, I don't see a godly man among them. Can we just have one godly man? So they send off for a godly man. Okay, we'll get one guy. Of course, it's still going to be 400 against one, but we're going to send him in. And all the prophets in the meantime, verse 12, were prophesying, saying, God's going to prosper you. Don't listen to anybody else. We know what's going on. And it says in verse 13, the message, then the messenger who went to summon Micaiah, who is the one prophet that probably wouldn't agree with him, spoke to him saying, behold, now the words of the prophets are uniformly favorable. So, hey, that's a good time to go, isn't it, to battle? When everybody agrees. I mean, who cares if they're righteous? They just all agree. That's one of the problems of democracy. You know, oh, well, majority rules. Okay, majority may be wrong. That's one of the big problems of majority. Anyway, uniformly favorably to the king, please let your word be likewise. And so they're kind of stacking the deck in their favor. Micaiah's going to come, and we're just letting you know. We all agree. So if you want to belong to the club, you're going to agree with us. So here goes. So they say, so what does the Lord say? In verse 15, Micaiah goes, he says, go, everything will be okay. And Ahab goes, okay, quit joking. He goes, all right, you're going to die. Okay, I told you this guy was no good. Poor guy can't win for losing. Verse 19, Micaiah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing by him on his right hand and his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab to go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said this, while another said that. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I'll lie to him. I'll entice him. I'll trick him. God goes, go. And sure enough, Ahab goes into battle. He was enticed, but he wanted to be enticed. And God was going to reveal, you want? See, that's one of the great themes that you see in the book of Jeremiah is that your wickedness, he actually says this in Jeremiah chapter 2, your wickedness will correct you. You ask for it, I give it to you. I'm going to reveal that it's not something you want to put your trust in. So as you come back to Jeremiah chapter 51, it is seen throughout that God is using the destroyers to destroy and to obviously reveal the fact that these are things that you cannot put your trust in. Another good example, of course, obviously, is Luke chapter 22, in which Peter puts his trust in himself. And as he puts himself trust in himself, he says, by sheer resolve, by determination, I'm not going to fall. I'm going to be loyal to God. And God, and Christ goes, okay, you've just invited Satan. Because you said that there's no power, there's no authority that you can't in some way beat. And I've got a volunteer that says he'll go in the ring with you. And obviously, when all was said and done, did Peter make it out? But it was necessary. I mean, if you think about this, think about this. Peter is going to establish with the other apostles the church. Think about this. He's going to establish the church. Now, what do you want the church trusting in? The ability of Peter to sustain the integrity of the church? Or do you want the church trusting on Christ alone? See? So it has to be revealed, and the necessity of the powers that are bogus have to be seen. And so the destroyer comes in to reveal these things, the God of regret, the God of grief, the god of deceit, the god of pride, will come in and reveal these things, and finally you go, okay, that's not real. As we come to Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 41, really the thrust of this particular passage is that God is sending the destroyer in to end, actually, the allurement of sin. There's a sin that is alluring us. Why? How is it alluring? Well, probably the best way to convey this is that it puts on glitz and it puts on a big house and it drives really good-looking cars and, you know, before long you're going, wow, that really looks nice. And yet Scripture is going to convey to us, but how ugly sin is. I mean, just because the garb seems to be fantastic and glorious, how ugly really sin is, how hateful avarice and greed really is. Think about it. How treacherous lust is. How murderous envy is. But the world makes all these things look so glamorous and so wonderful. I mean, it dances it in such grand and glorious parading of pride and great pomp and circumstance that you begin to walk away and you go, wow, that's really a glorious thing. I mean, the arrogance of man, he parades. And we go to the parades because the parades are so beautiful. But all the parades are really just the glory of man declaring himself as so wonderful. And if you look behind, you look behind the scenes, you begin to say, how ugly that is. The passage in chapter 51, verse 41 through 44 is really declaring just the ugliness of these things. And God is saying, not only am I going to destroy the destroyer, I'm going to destroy the allurement of the destroyer. So the reason that God is doing the things the way that he's doing it is to reveal. When I was a kid, we had a real, real scary movie. Now, I know today, if the movie was shown, the little kids would go, what? But me, I was hiding under the covers. And it was The Wizard of Oz. And, you know, I still can't get those monkeys out of my head. But it was a scary thing. But the whole movie is fundamentally based on, you're looking at something that seems glorious, but all you have to do is walk behind the curtain and find out it's just a farce. I mean, you have this guy that's the Great Oz, and he's promising all these great things. What does he really do? He can't really do anything. And so what the story does is it pulls back the curtain, and it begins to reveal what really is important, and that is the home that they had and the things of the relationship that have always been the treasures of man. Oz, the world, begins to allure us and say, we have some glorious and wonderful things here. God goes, okay, let me pull back the curtain. If, in fact, you understand the book of Revelation, that's one of its main purposes. The main purpose, one of the main purposes of the book of Revelation is to unveil or to pull back the curtain. And what he begins to do is he begins to reveal, okay, you've fallen in love with this woman. Let me show you what she's like. And he begins to pull back the veil. The sorrow and the grief are certainly a part of it, but the horror of the effect of, I had no idea that there was a dragon here. You know, you just pull back and you go, okay, so I don't even want a part of this when you begin to see the reality. It's the same thing that's true in chapter 51 and verse 41. If you look at the very beginning of the verse, how Shishak has captured. Now, what we understand is Shishak is actually cryptographic, which means that it has a cryptic meaning, which means that it is actually pointing to something that they don't necessarily want to reveal, or they're going to reveal in a different way. What is it that they're pointing to? Well, if you drop on down the same verse, how Babylon. So Shishak is actually a cryptographic word for Babylon. Why would they use that particular word? Well, I believe that one of the reasons why that this word would be used is that it's kind of found as a declarative of a kind of goddess that was in Babylon. and it was a goddess that was good at alluring, oftentimes equated with linen and wearing linen things and alluring the men to come in. So it's as if the description is one of a woman. Of course, obviously, Babylon is made mention of as a harlot who is calling out. So it's this woman that is alluring. I think it's, if you go all the way back to Jeremiah, we won't turn there, but Jeremiah chapter 13, one of the things that God has Jeremiah do is to wear, if you remember, a linen waist. And then he says, okay, I want you to plant it by the river of Euphrates. Remember that? And then it kind of rots. God goes, okay, you perceive this as a glorious thing. Watch it rot. And what God is going to reveal is the things that are alluring you are just rotten things. And they're very destructive. So if you look within the past, this passage begins by how Sheshach has been captured. Now, the reason why it uses those particular phrases is, Lakhad is making reference to the fact that as Babylon ensnared, Babylon will be ensnared. God, through his discipline, through his punishment of Babylon, is going to convey all the things that she did. So he's not just getting rid of evil, he's revealing it. And this is a very important point. Because the difficulties in your life is not just God getting after you. It's God revealing what is hurting you. And the things that you're embracing are the very things that are really destroying your life. So he begins to reveal the inability, really, of this beautiful goddess to hold and to captivate any longer. In fact, she's going to be captured. In other words, at one time, she captured people, but she has no power anymore. What happened? Well, the only thing that happened is God has revealed the reality of who she is. How Sheshach has been captured, and the praise, watch the next phrase, the praise of the whole earth has been seized. The emphasis, of course, of Tehillah is adoration and the glory, and it gives an interesting picture of Babylon being seen as such a wonderful, glorious place. If you back up into chapter 51 and you look in verse 7, it kind of gives that picture of Babylon, once again, intoxicating the whole earth. See that verse 7? Babylon has been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord, intoxicating all the earth. The nations have drunk of her wine, therefore the nations are going mad. Suddenly Babylon has fallen, been broken. It's an interesting picture. Of course, Isaiah 47 begins to reveal she has her spells, she has her sorcery, she has her counselors, she has her astrologers, she has those that are trafficking in trade, and these are all very alluring things. In fact, in Isaiah 47, it goes on to say in verse 5, she literally sits as queen of the heavens. Jeremiah 50 will tell us she is the mother of all nations. What is it that makes her the mother of all nations? Well, once again, I mean, she has her officials, she has her wise men. This is chapter 50 of Jeremiah, by the way, verses 33 through 40. She has her officials, her wise men. She has her priests, her counselors. She has her mighty men. She has her horses, her chariots, her treasures, her resources. That's why if you look in chapter 51, in verse 13, it says, you who dwell by many waters, abundant in your treasures. Yeah. Of course, Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 1 and 2 would say stupid wise men. I mean, he goes on to say in chapter 51, verse 17, what does he say? All mankind is stupid. Devoid of knowledge, every goldsmith is put to shame by his idols. His molded images are deceitful. No wonder, you know, God says in verse 25, behold, I am against you, O destroying mountain. Because by your allurements, you have deceived the world. And once again, it is through the pomp and circumstance. Isaiah 14 describes Babylon and as using music. Well, the world would never use music to allure me. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You're sitting in your car. You're jumping around singing a song. Did you listen to the words? Yeah, it was the music. So he says in chapter 14 of Isaiah, verse 11, your pomp and your music of your harps have actually been a source of. And if you go all the way back to Revelation, if you just look there with me again in chapter 18, because it really is a very revealing passage. But in Revelation chapter 18, what does he say? Well, he talks about those things that were used to allure, and he says, no longer will they be used. In other words, I'm taking out the allurement. If you look in chapter 18, and we've gone past all the cargo of the merchants and all the fine linen and all the purple and all the gold and all the silver and even the trafficking of men. If you look in chapter 18, verse 21, it reads, and the strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer. The sound, verse 21, of what? Of the harpists, the musicians, the flute players, the trumpeters will not be heard in you any longer. What is he saying? You've been using those to allure people, right? It's your music, right? It says in verse 23, and the light of the lamp will not shine in you any longer. The voice of the bridegroom and the bride will not be heard any longer. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, because of all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and of all those who have been slain. You use things to entrap people. I'm going to destroy all the entrapments. So God's not just destroying the destroyers. He's destroying the allurement of the destroyers. And how important that is, if you understand, because that's what's been calling people in. And this is what this whole text is about. If you look, go back to chapter 51, Babylon has become an object of horror, he goes on to say in verse 41. Horror to the nations who at one time looked and went to them. It says in verse 42 of chapter 51, the sea has come up over Babylon. Why does he make mention specifically of that? Well, the sea in this particular context is actually translated the broad river, the Euphrates. But his point, obviously, is that you've used your resources to overwhelm and to enslave and to engulf people. It's an interesting picture, because when you think about the world, well, let's just stop here and let's think a minute. Does the world put any pressure on you? Or do you feel carefree? See? The hardships and the pain and the suffering and the feeling that I'm overwhelmed, I feel like I'm in a turmoil of waters that are just stirring me around. I don't even feel like I'm in control anymore. What do you think that comes from? Well, that comes from Babylon. So he says, the sea has come up over Babylon, because that's what you've done to the people. You've put them in a whirlwind of debt, of anxiety, of frustration, of confusion. She has engulfed other people, so she will be engulfed with its tumultuous waves. Her cities have become an object of horror, of waste, a parched land, the desert, actually kind of taken from Jeremiah 4:23, tohu bohu. The earth was formless and void, or more specifically, it's empty and meaningless. The city, the world, makes your life empty and meaningless. I mean, they promise you all these wonderful things. If you look with me in chapter 51, verse 58, read this verse with me. Thus says the Lord God of hosts, the broad wall of Babylon will be completely razed. Her high gates will be set on fire. So the peoples will toil for. What have you been working for all your life? Nothing. Nothing. And what is God trying to reveal to us? You see, the wonderful thing about Christians, God's people, is, as Hebrews says, who the Lord loves, he disciplines. Right? If you're without discipline, you're not God's children. So if, in fact, in your life, you've not been able to get all the stuff, if within your life it seems to be elusive to you, if, in fact, in your life, you just can't seem to find that satisfaction in that stuff, that's God's goodness. That's God. God has been destroying. You go, I'm just trying to get, you know, above water. God goes, I'm trying to show you that you can't. And that stuff is not going to save you. You're holding on to gold and you're saying, I hope it floats. And God's saying, it's not going to. So let it go. And it's the graciousness of God that begins to reveal these things in the lives of believers, because unbelievers, they live all their life believing the lie, and then it comes to the end and it says, and evil will come upon them suddenly. You know, the grace of God that doesn't allow it to come suddenly on us, but he allows the destroyer to take care of the pride of our life, to the sense of self-confidence, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, I'm going to go to such and such a city. He goes, wait a minute, that's not going to work for you. You're my kid and I don't want you putting your trust in those things. It's the grace of God. So as we read through this, he is really saying, you know, I'm destroying all these things that you can see, that these are not things that you should put your trust in. It says in verse 43, her cities have become an object of horror, a parched land in the desert, land in which no man lives. That is to say, there's no life in this place. I know that it's an interesting picture when you see pictures of the Mardi Gras and stuff like this, and you see people marching down. Of course, if you were to go down to South America, you see some of these same parades. But people are dressed up in they look like they're dead. And it's like the marching dead. And it's a perfect picture. It really is a perfect picture of the world. They're walking around as dead men. But there's no life in them. There's no excitement about the future. They're just hoping that they can hang on to something and find some kind of joy. But they're even faking the joy. They've got to drink some joy in them, or, you know, put some drug in them to find some kind or some sense of joy. Their cities have become a place where no man lives, and through which no man or son of man passes. In other words, God's going to make it to where nobody wants to be there. But that's the grace of God, because the things that come into our life at this time, as God is beginning his work through the destroyer, is God pulls back those curtains and you go, you know what? I don't even want that anymore. I mean, there was a time where you embraced it. There was a time that you longed for it. There was a time that you went strong after it. But through the process of God pulling back the curtains, you go, you know, there's nothing about that that I love. In fact, you grow a tremendous disdain for it. And God goes, okay, I'm working on your life. I'm working on your life. By the time you come to the end of your life, you love those right things. And you're ready to go home. God is preparing us for home, and it's just a wonderful thing in which he destroys these things that, you know, are just destructive in our lives. It says in verse 44, if you'll look in verse 44, I shall punish Bel and Babylon. You see that particular text? If you look with me in Isaiah 46, he makes mention of this as well. And there is a reason why he makes mention. Of course, he's already made mention of Bel within the text. And if you look with me in chapter 46 in verse 1, it says in Isaiah, Baal has bowed down. Now what we know is that Baal is a god of Babylon, one of the great gods of Babylon. What you may not know is what he represents. And what he represents is power and good fortune. So it's an interesting allurement, isn't it? Baal, who promises grand and glorious things of good fortune. I'm going to give you a lot of stuff. You're going to be wealthy beyond your imagination. So if you look in chapter 46, verse 1, what does it say about Bel? He's bowed down. The point of the passage is that the bowing down is not just simply him showing any kind of allegiance or actually coming before somebody greater than him, but it actually literally means that he falls down for want of strength. What the world is telling you is that the good fortune is your strength. And what God is saying is, I'm going to show you it's not. I'm going to show you the weakness of good fortune. So he says in the first part, Bel has bowed down. Now what's the second part? Nebo, which by the way, is where Nebuchadnezzar gets his name. Nebuchadnezzar. So what does that mean? Well, Nebo is the god of learning. You can put education in here. I probably haven't heard this before, but knowledge is power. And so the perception is that the God of learning, the God of books, the God of literature, the God of man's wisdom is his strength. This is where he's going to find his strength. And yet the text says Nebo stoops over, which in the old versions actually is translated is broken. It's like, have you seen our educational plan? It's broken. It's not working. It's not going to give you the kind of power that will sustain you forever. It says, Baal has bowed down, Nebo stoops over. Their images are consigned to the beast and the cattle. It's God's way of saying, you know where they belong? Yeah. The things that you carry are burdensome, so you can't, you've made these great gods, and now you've got to lug them around. So how is your life easier? People work so hard at accumulating stuff, and they go, I just have to have that to make me happy. Where am I going to put it? And then now we got to move it. And you find yourself working for all these things that are not really enhancing your life, but are actually complicating your life. The things that you carry are burdensome. The load of weary beasts, they stooped over. They have bowed down together. They could not rescue. You see, these things don't rescue you from your burdens. They give you greater burdens. The things of this world don't actually rescue you at all. They have themselves gone into captivity. I like the way that it's put in verse 3 and 4. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. You have been born by me from birth. I carried you from birth. Watch the next text. You have been carried from the womb. You didn't carry me. I've been carrying you. Even to your old age, this is a part I like. Even to your old age, I shall be the same, and even in your grain years, I shall bear you. I have done it. I shall carry you. I shall bear you, and I shall deliver you. And that's a lot different than the gods of the world. When you go through trouble and difficulty and hardship and pain and suffering, and the destroyer starts coming in your life, you know what it begins to reveal? It begins to reveal how hopeless and helpless and how utterly meaningless the things that you have accumulated are to save you. This is one of the reasons why, you know, I'll oftentimes tell parents, don't go up to your kid and say things like, I'll always be there for you. I'll be the one to rescue you. I'll be there, because the day is going to come where that's not going to be true. Don't set them up for that. You set yourself up to be a god, you're not going to be there. What you need to do is put their hand in the one who is. Amen. The one who will never leave them, who will never forsake them, who has the power to sustain them and keep them forever. That's what you need to do. Otherwise, you are being not only deceitful, but evil and destructive in their lives. You are promising things that you can never keep, and you are actually building them up in the realm of emptiness. But God will not leave them. Verse 5, to whom would you liken me? To whom could be my equal? That you would compare me, that we should be alike. Those who lavish gold from purse, weigh silver on the scale. I like the way that's put. Do you think my power comes out of a purse? I can just see God. You know, let me help you, dear. You know, when the purse, and God goes, you think my power comes out of a purse? My power doesn't come out. You think I have to hire people to do things and to make a god? And you think that, I'll somehow get people to do the things that need to be done to set your life straight? They can only lift things on their shoulder. They set it in its place. It stands there. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't move from its place. That's verse 7. The one may cry to it, it doesn't answer. You ever really, in great sorrow, have you ever looked at a dollar bill and just, help me, comfort me? Have you ever seen the dollar bill just go, okay, it'll be okay? I've just never seen it happen. The one may cry out, it cannot answer, cannot deliver him from distress. Remember this, be assured, recall it to mind, transgressors. Remember the former things long past. I'm God. There's no one like me. I'm God. There's no one like me. I declare the end from the beginning, the ancient times. My purpose will be established. Everything that I set out to do will happen. Who do you want to put your trust in? And the passage is actually telling us within the text, I shall punish Bel and Babylon. You think good fortune is going to save you? It's not going to save you. I shall make what he has swallowed up come out of his mouth. I love that text. Because if you back up into chapter 51 of Jeremiah, and you back up and you look at verse 34, what does it say? Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has devoured me. Right? If you look at the end of verse 34, he has swallowed me like a monster. The lies of the world that come to you that say, come, take the good fortune, are swallowing you up. That's what they're doing. The promise of education is swallowing you up. I shall punish Bel and Babylon. I shall make what he has swallowed come out of his mouth. And the nations, I love the way this ends, the nations will no longer stream to him. That's an interesting picture because I'm sure that that's kind of happening in Miami today. You see the streaming of humanity, the long lines, the tremendous amounts of money being spent. And I'm not anti, but I'm just telling you, look at all that man does for a moment of entertainment. And quite frankly, you're going to have probably at least 50% of the people are going to be really upset by the time they leave. The nations will no longer stream to him, even the wall. See the passage there? Of Babylon has fallen down. You know why he adds that in? Because the purpose of the wall, actually the description and the etymology of it, is that the wall is something that is perceived as difficult to approach. Now, the reason why that's significant is this, is that man has a proclivity to be drawn to things that are difficult to approach. You build a big wall, he wants to look in it. He's looking for a crack to look through it. The bigger the wall, the more he wants to go in. And the passage is really saying that God has taken that wall down to a place, probably, it can be a catastrophic fall, but it can actually infer to just a crumbling. And it's an interesting picture in which the very thing that man has, one of the reasons why they call the mystic religions, mysterious religions, is that it kind of has this sense of what is behind that. And it has a draw to it. And God is saying, I'm taking away all the draw, I'm taking away. And that's one of the great reasons for the book of Revelation is God is pulling out all the stops. And he goes, you have no idea what this looks like. You sit down with your child and your child thinks that, you know, hanging around a certain group of people is just going to be the greatest thing that could ever happen to them. You know, if they could just be liked by this group of people. But you know what they're like. You know what they're offering. You know the destruction that's behind this and the misery that's there. What can you do to pull it back? Well, sometimes difficult times have to come in to reveal to the people that you love. And God is doing that in our lives. When difficult times, and it's the reason why James says, consider it all joy. When you have these trials and these pains because God is revealing something, instead of you going, I'm gonna stop the pain, what you need to do is say, what's causing the pain? And stop going to it. Because that's the source of your heartache. And God is trying to, God is revealing that to you. And it's his graciousness that will continue to reveal it to you. Who the Lord loves, he disciplines. God is opening up the walls. He's pulling back the curtains. He's revealing the things that need to be revealed. And it's certainly the graciousness of God. Jeremiah 2:19 says, your own wickedness will correct you. God is showing the destruction of Babylon. Father, we come before you today and we just ask you to work within our hearts. There are difficult things that are happening in our life, problems that ensue. pressures that come upon us, waves and billows of tumult that begin to feel like we're drowning, that we just can't seem to be or to get ahead. We are overwhelmed by the oppressiveness of the things that have come into our life, and yet it is you who sent the destroyer. The destroyer is revealing who he really is. And the allurement is now being seen for what it really is. It's just deception. It's been smoke and mirrors all along, and we have fallen for it. But today, we see it as something different. Father, it is your graciousness that has called us to see the reality of this world, but nowhere do we see it more clearly than on the cross. The world says that it's loving. The world says that it's kind. The world says that it's patient. The world says that it's very giving and very generous. The world says that it will rescue you. But the bottom line is the world will crucify you. The world hates that which is good. That's the truth. And all that is perceived as grand and glorious, when we look at the cross, seems so terrible. It is at the cross that we begin to see the reality, and we begin to set down all of those trophies for that which is far more valuable. For not only on the cross do we see the horrific nature of man, we see the wonderful love of God. That's what we want. Your head's bowed and your eyes closed. In a sunny place, you pray. Rise and sing that song with us. At the cross, where I first saw the light.
At the cross, where I first saw the light, and the burden of my heart rolled away. It was there by faith I receive. happy all the day.
See, Christ wasn't just dying for your sins. He's revealing the evil. Lord bless you.